all the appliances, but we must find a good development strategy.
Mohamed Nasheed, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ousted president of the Maldives has just received political refugee status in Britain. We will continue this conversation. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is a hiring and news producer, as well as an office coordinator, both full-time jobs in New York. Check our website at democracynow.org. The job openings are immediate. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 p.m. And coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, to take place in locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence is an annual celebration of placemaking, community, natural building, music, and art. During the daytime, there will be 35 natural building and public arts projects to take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a film premiere gala and fundraiser for Outside the Frame, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Outside the Frame is a new organization that empowers homeless and marginalized youth by producing films with youth that convey their life experience. They will premiere The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a riff on Peter Pan, where real lost boys and girls debate if and how to return to mainstream society. They will also screen original film shorts by homeless youth about issues such as drug abuse, gender identity, and the healthcare system. Again, that's The Lost Boys of Portlandia, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I am a lost boy.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an oil train derails outside Mosier, Oregon, near the Columbia River Gorge Basin, resulting in an oil fire, building evacuations, and road closures.
We look at safety regulations and past criticisms of transporting tankers by rail.
And in international news, the UN considers humanitarian airdrops after the Syrian government allows their efforts to lapse.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 3rd, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. There's been a multi-car train derailment in the Columbia Gorge near the community of Mosier, Oregon. Almost a dozen cars derailed during the noon hour, and two are on fire. The smoke plume is visible for miles, but there is no word so far of casualties. The accident appears to have happened right near Mosier Elementary School, which has been evacuated. The Union Pacific Railroad has confirmed that it was a Union Pacific train and that it was carrying Canadian Bakken oil headed for a refinery in Tacoma, Washington. The accident happened days before a scheduled Mosier area rail expansion meeting between county planners and Union Pacific. It also comes weeks before the final hearing on whether the Port of Vancouver should build the Tesora Savage oil terminal on the Columbia River. Fire crews have responded to today's accident, and Interstate 84 between Mosier and the Dalles is shut down. KBOO News spoke with Mosier resident Justin Brimmer about what he saw.
Huge black clouds all large, 20-foot tall flames coming from what appeared to be the railroad tracks. It's very distinctable. It's kind of on an island between where the gorge cuts into the river. There's a little island with the railroad track. So there's definitely flames coming from the railroad track. Went to get off the exit. Police had the exit closed. I told them I live up there. They said this exit's closed. The road's closed. Told me how to go. I said, I'm actually a member of the media. What happened? And he said, well, it's only railroad tracks. That's all I can say.
While Mosier faces an environmental crisis, we talk about the complex relationship between the community, Union Pacific, and its regulators. KBOO's John Pacheco has more.
In light of today's tragedy in Mosier, KBOO has discovered that ODOT and Union Pacific have known about crude oil shipments through Mosier and failed to report it to Mosier Fire District. In an article by the Oregonian in April of 2014, Mosier officials have been kept in the dark about crude oil shipments through the gorge. Matt Garrett, former ODOT director, took swift action to ensure Oregonians at ODOT would immediately tell railroad companies to submit annual reports of crude oil shipments. Oil shipments increased 250% between the years 2013 to 2014. However, ODOT and Union Pacific have been given piecemeal information to the public, and in the midst of this controversy, mile-long oil trains continue to move through the gorge without any knowledge. Evidence of this came to light in April when a photographer photographed an oil train moving through the gorge. No reports of illegality and wrongdoing have been reported as of today. We will report any new developments here on KBOO News. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm John Pacheco.
In March of last year, a group of Democratic senators introduced legislation aimed at improving the safety of oil transport by rail. The number of oil trains in the United States has increased exponentially over the last decade. In 2008, there were less than 10,000 rail cars a year transporting oil. By 2012, there were more than 500,000, and the number has increased since then. But regulations have not kept pace. The Crude by Rail Safety Act was meant to address safety by establishing a national standard for the maximum volatility of crude oil transported by rail. There's currently no such standard in place, leading supporters of the bill to say that an oil derailment on the scale of the 2013 Lac Mégantic in Canada is imminent. That disaster killed 47 Canadians when an unattended 74-car train derailed and exploded in the town. The crude by rail bill remains stuck in committee, with Republican legislators preventing it from moving forward to the Senate floor for a vote. KBOO's Mike Kleffer spoke 1 year ago with Jared Margolis from the Center for Biological Diversity on the bill, which later died in Congress.
The problem is that there's been new rules that have been proposed by the Department of Transportation, and those rules, while they would create a slightly safer tank car, the problem is that these tank cars are allowed to travel well in excess of those design capacities. So, in other words, these tank cars puncture at 18 miles per hour, but they're allowed to travel 40 or 50 miles per hour. So this takes a step in the right direction in terms of getting the really unsafe tank cars off the road, but we still have some concerns about the speed that even the replacement tank cars would be allowed to travel. The bill also does a couple of important things, like requiring comprehensive oil spill response plans for the oil shippers, and that's really essential because that requires the shippers to have, by contract, to make sure that they have sufficient personnel and equipment to respond to a worst-case event. So it's a really important provision.
That was KBOO's Mike Kleffer about 1 year ago speaking with Jared Margolis from the Center for Biological Diversity on a bill, the Crude by Rail Bill, which died in Congress.
In May of last year, the Department of Transportation released updated safety standards concerning older rail cars carrying explosive fuels. The regulations were criticized by community and environmental advocacy groups. The older cars are more prone to derailment and no longer meet current safety standards. The new regulations allowed for a 10-year period to phase out the unsafe cars. Critics have called that timeline unacceptable. They cite the Department of Transportation's own data projecting that 15 derailments of older rail cars will happen every year. Matt Krogh is campaign director of Forest Ethics Extreme Oil. He pointed out that much of the new regulations appear to have been heavily influenced by oil industry lobbyists. Other critics of the rules point out that the oil cars still don't have adequate speed limits and they can still be grouped in large continuous blocks of 19 rail cars containing explosive crude.
As oil train cars burn in Mosier, the Port of Vancouver prepares for its final meetings on whether to approve the Tesoro oil terminal on the Columbia River. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with the Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director Dan Sears about what happens next.
Dan Sears, why is this train derailment in Mosier so important in terms of its timing and how it will impact Tesoro negotiations in the Port of Vancouver?
So right now, the state of Washington is undertaking its process in earnest to decide whether or not to approve the largest oil-by-rail terminal in North America in Vancouver, Washington. So the same type of train carrying the same type of fuel could be coming to Vancouver, Washington. The same event that happened in Mosier today could be replicated really anywhere along the Columbia River if the Tesoro project were allowed to move forward. And so at the end of this month, the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council for Washington will be meeting in Vancouver, and we have an increasingly compelling case for why the state of Washington and Governor Inslee need to flat out reject any of these projects. And in fact, we need to stop oil train shipments altogether.
Dan, what is the public's role in these hearings?
You know, the public really has a role to play in bringing the attention of the decision makers to the issues that we care about. The Columbia River, Mosier, the elementary school that was right nearby where this oil train derailment happened today and is happening right now where the fire is still burning. The fisheries that we have fought and worked to restore and protect, and you know, the downtown and community of Vancouver and Portland, all of these things are at risk. And what we do is put a human face and real backbone to the people who want to do the right thing. And we think Governor Inslee can do the right thing. He can reject these projects. The question becomes, what are we going to do with the oil trains that are already running? And we need to stop those from moving down the tracks because clearly they pose a danger to all of these communities. We've known that for a long time, and today's events are just a gut-wrenching reminder of how reckless oil-by-rail shipments can be.
Dan Sears, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Lisa.
I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO News.
Gattex Corporation leases the rail cars involved in today's derailment near Mosier. It appears on the list of parties potentially responsible for the Portland Harbor Superfund site. The Environmental Protection Agency has fined the firm five times since 2010, most recently for exceeding permitted emissions of formaldehyde in Georgia last year. A report on the increase in oil trains in the region released Tuesday raised concerns about how accident-prone a 5,000% increase in rail traffic might be. According to the study, there were more derailments in 2013 than in the 40 previous years combined.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For Portland's weather, it will be mostly clear tonight with a low of 64. Tomorrow will be hot with a high of 99. And then tomorrow night will be mostly clear with a low of 67. Today in history, in 1989, the Chinese government crackdown in Tiananmen Square began. With protests for democratic reforms entering their seventh week, the Chinese government authorized its soldiers and tanks to reclaim Beijing's Tiananmen Square at all costs. Chinese troops forcibly cleared the square, killing hundreds and arresting thousands of demonstrators and suspected dissidents. The quote of the day is from Robert Kennedy, who said, quote, "Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance." End quote.
Men Who Move and States That Shake. Here's this week's F Word with Laura Flanders.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. One man moves and a whole state shakes. When that one man is hedge fund billionaire David Tepper, that's just what happens. David Tepper is a multi-billion dollar hedge fund manager who's lived in New Jersey for 20 years. Now he's moving his home and his business to low-tax Florida, and that'll cost New Jersey millions, probably hundreds of millions, in lost tax revenue. New Jersey's not alone. According to one New York Times report, the top 1% of residents pay a third or more of total income taxes in half a dozen states: New Jersey, New York, California, Connecticut, and Maryland. Wealth has flowed so much from the bottom to the top that entire states are now dependent on a tiny, powerful class. What's a state to do? The Times reports that states are doing everything they can to get their fat cats to stay. But really, is that the only way to go? I took a look at Tepper's wealth. First, it's financial wealth. Hedge fund managers don't make things or sell things, they place bets. Tepper made a whole hunk of his wealth, some $4 billion, from a 2009 investment in distressed financial stocks, including Bank of America. Buying low, he was able to sell high when it recovered. But who helped it recover? We did, taxpayers. In 2008 and 2009, Bank of America received $45 billion from the U.S. government through the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Remember TARP? And a $118 billion federal guarantee against loss. While we're talking rich, it's a bit darn rich for him to fret about paying back, isn't it? And a bit ridiculous of New Jerseyans to do anything but bid guys like that good riddance and set about distributing their assets more widely. Have we forgotten everything we ever knew about the U.S. Revolution? No aristocrats, no feudal lords welcome here. Comments? Write to me, laura@lauraflanders.com. And thanks.
Two defendants associated with the 41-day armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge were released from custody yesterday. A federal judge ordered the release of Jake Ryan, age 27, and Travis Cox, 21, from custody on Thursday. The two are facing federal conspiracy charges for their participation in the refuge takeover between January and February of this year. During the takeover, a video was made showing Ryan operating a federally owned excavator at the refuge in Burns, Oregon. Ryan and Cox will be released with curfews and conditions, which include travel restrictions, no contact with militia members, and no protest pending trial. Ryan became a fugitive after the takeover until he was caught in Clark County, Washington on April 5th. He was armed with a .45 caliber handgun and knives. Both men are now under their parents' custody.
Are you having some construction done at your house? If you want to make sure the contractors are licensed, you'll have to wait. The Oregon Construction Contractors Board, the CCB, says a security breach on their website prompted them to shut it down. The CCB regulates construction contracting businesses. It issues licenses and tracks complaints against contractors. The Oregon Chief Information Office says they're trying to figure out whether any personal information was stolen. Earlier this week, someone broke into a CCB-hosted database. Government agencies use it to verify that bidders meet state requirements. The CCB says emails and passwords of government users were found on the internet. State officials believe that the CCB's contractor licensing database that contains contractors' personal information was also vulnerable. This is the page where consumers verify that a contractor is licensed, bonded, and insured. The CCB shut the database. They say it'll stay shut down while the agency figures out what happened.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Los Angeles striking port truckers, elected officials, clergy, and community leaders held a press conference Thursday to protest the planned closing of the port. Workers planned what they said would be a massive protest at the Los Angeles Harbor Commission meeting. Hundreds of striking workers are demanding that port companies stop violating labor laws. Picket lines continued at Port of Los Angeles terminals and marine yards Thursday. The workers say misclassification as contractors rather than employees resulted and wage theft and other labor rights violations. Port drivers so far have been awarded more than $32 million in back pay and 300 separate decisions by California's labor commissioner. There are more than 500 more wage theft cases waiting to be heard. The Graduate Employees Union at Portland State University has been certified by Oregon's Employment Relations Board, bringing 800 new workers into the labor movement. The new union for Portland State University graduate students is affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers. Andres Oswell is a grad student worker at Portland State.
Something that comes up a lot is pushback that graduate employees are seen as students. I think the fact that this is something that's become such a widespread issue has shown that there really is a collective interest around the workers as employees and the situation that they have as employees at the university. So that's something we're really excited to be a part of. It's pretty exciting because there hasn't been a large-scale public employee unionization in Oregon for a while. So we're pretty excited about everything that's happened.
The Graduate Employees Union is working to identify issues and prepare to bargain their first contract. Oswell says that the union has a good relationship with the university. He says in addition to compensation, issues include health care costs, workload increases, and fees charged to the graduate students. Hillary Clinton blasted Donald Trump's ability to be president Thursday, slamming him as dangerously incoherent.
I believe the person the Republicans have nominated for president cannot do the job. Donald Trump's ideas aren't just different. They are dangerously incoherent. They're not even really ideas, just a series of bizarre rants, personal feuds, and outright lies.
The Chicago Teachers Union and the Chicago Public Schools met Thursday for a bargaining session on a new labor contract for teachers. CTU President Karen Lewis says teachers might be willing to forgo annual raises in the new contract if Chicago and the state government step up to find other revenue sources for Chicago public schools. Lewis is critical of comments from the district's CEO, Forrest Claypool, that schools may not open in September due to what Lewis calls the district's broke-on-purpose fiscal crisis. Lewis says that statement is another example of Claypool's failed leadership. WIN is made possible in part by the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Gaza Strip has never been a major tourist destination, though before Israel clamped down, visitors came not only to the beach, but also to explore the area's more than 30 ancient sites. For almost a decade now, tourism has been nearly non-existent, and archaeological work all but stopped. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Here at the Rafah Hilltop, the largest and most ancient of Gaza's archaeological sites, three workers use primitive tools to excavate ancient artifacts that can be traced back some 4,000 years. But ever since the Israeli siege of Gaza in 2007, these historical relics have been all abandoned by foreign delegations and international tourists. Assad Ashour is a leading Gaza-based historical researcher.
In the past, foreign archaeological expeditions interested in maintaining and excavating these sites, especially tourists and journalists from France, would come to Gaza. But Gaza is a small region, and with the ongoing instability here and the frequent wars, it can't be considered a tourist destination.
The region is home to dozens of significant archaeological sites, including the Bacha Palace, the Byzantine Church, and the Barkuk Castle. Ashour explains that throughout history, Gaza fell under various rules, including the Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptian Mamluks, and the Ottomans, all left behind signs of their presence, from shards of pottery to ancient mosques. Many of the remaining historic structures reveal the ongoing instability and the frequent wars here. According to the Gaza-based tourism ministry, both the 700-year-old Bacha Palace and the 300-year-old Ottoman Mosque were damaged during the 2014 Israeli offensive in the region. Marwan Chahwan owns a private museum located in Khan Yunis, a city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. There are no publicly operated museums in Gaza, and just a few that are privately owned, like Chahwan's. He describes some of the antiquities in his collection, including clay pots and swords dating back as far as 5,000 years.
I began collecting artifacts in a marketplace when I found an ancient clay-made water jug. Afterwards, when I traveled to Rafah City for work, I asked people about ancient items and collected all these things that you now see.
And much more is likely yet to be discovered in Gaza, remaining buried by both time and conflict. In early April, a construction crew breaking ground for a shopping center unearthed an ancient Byzantine church, yet work on the shopping center continues, with no plans to pause for any further excavation. And even if there were, recovering and preserving newly discovered antiquities proves challenging. Hayam Albitar is a senior staff member with the Tourism and Archaeology Ministry. She says the siege has largely stopped archaeological reconstruction and maintenance projects in Gaza.
We lack white cement and some of the chemicals used in brushing and cleaning metal items. Of course, the Israelis argue that such substances are dual use and could be used in activities other than antiquities maintenance. These include some alcohols like ethyl or C2H5. And we don't have the advanced equipment we need to locate antiquities within the various sites.
And with so few people coming to Gaza to either work on or visit these significant historical sites, the ripple effect is felt in the local economy as well. According to Gaza's tourism ministry, prior to the Israeli siege, the tourism sector contributed about 5% of the region's GDP. Now, because of current conditions, it's no more than 2%. In 2011, Palestine gained admittance to the UN's Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. Efforts are underway to get significant Palestinian historical sites designated as UNESCO World Heritage Sites, but none of them are in Gaza. Back at the Rafah hilltop, limited excavations continue. But with most of Gaza's historical sites falling into disrepair through lack of a proper maintenance and physical stressors in repeated wars, perhaps those sites, still undiscovered, are safest left as is for now. Rami Al-Mighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
The June 1st deadline for the Syrian government to allow humanitarian aid to reach a list of besieged towns has come and gone. Nell Abrams has more from Free Speech Radio News.
The World Food Program is now considering airdropping aid packages, and the UN Security Council met Friday on the issue. Thursday, UN Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, Ramzi E. Ramzi, reiterated that land delivery is by far the best way to get the most aid to the most people, especially in urban areas.
Air delivery is certainly not a substitute for land delivery. Land delivery is more effective, more efficient, and less costly. Air delivery is complex and extremely expensive, but it remains an option if land deliveries do not go through.
It's unclear if any mechanisms exist to actually enforce the June 1st deadline, but it does apply a degree of international pressure on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to stop foot-dragging on aid deliveries. UN Senior Advisor Jan Egeland.
May was a very bad month for us as a humanitarian task force. We reached many fewer places and many fewer people than we did in March and April. June can be, seems to become much better. Not only because we reached Daraya for the first time since 2012, since it was besieged with the first limited humanitarian installment, but also because we actually plan to go to 11 besieged areas in the next few days.
The UN and the Red Crescent struck a cautiously optimistic tone about the very limited aid that was delivered to Daraya. But nearly none of what did get through was the basic survival necessities that the people stranded there most need. No food, no water purifiers, and little medicine. As of Friday morning, there was still no set date for delivery of the balance of the aid. Syrian officials did enter the public statement fray Friday, saying the government would allow humanitarian aid to reach a limited number of areas, including almost a dozen that are besieged. But similar commitments have been made in the past without follow-through. The UN's Humanitarian Aid Task Force has a list of 19 locations in Syria it hopes to reach and says nearly 600,000 people are now stranded in besieged areas of the civil war-torn country.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, John Pacheco, Robin Ryan, and Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. The producer for tonight's news is David Kesters, and our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.4. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More